Chapter 34. Liam and Foster sat at a corner booth at Portillo's. Liam had talked Foster into an Italian beef and sausage combo with sweet and hot peppers, large bag of fries, several paper napkins.
"You eat this stuff very often?"
Foster said, wiping his mouth. The crown of his head was sweating from the hot peppers. "Every chance I get."
"How did the morning session go?"
"Dizzying."
"You mean the volume of the information?"
"Well, that, and she was practically sitting on my lap in that little office."
"You're a lucky man.
A lot of guys in the department would pay big money for that privilege." Liam smiled and nodded. "Kayla's an impressive woman in a lot of ways. She certainly knows her history. She's telling me more than I can absorb, but I'm also getting a good background on the Alzahanis."
"We know a lot more about his father and grandfather than we know about Arif. His profile is scant. Kayla says he consorts with Faiz Talib, who's an agency watchlist favorite, but we're not sure exactly how extensive this Sons of Canaan group is and where they operate. They're careful about where and how they meet. So far, we haven't been able to infiltrate their organization. That's why we're hoping you might pick up some information. Not only who the members are, but what they're up to. Obviously, that's why she wants you to go over there."
"I figured it was broader than the ransom exchange. But I don't know if I'm comfortable being Kayla's operative."
"Well, operative's a little strong. Right now, we just want you to learn whatever you can."
"And you'll give me names? Starting points? People to contact?" Foster nodded.
"Kayla knows people. Jamal Abu Hamad, for one. He's an old-timer who owns an antiquities shop in the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem. For a long time, he lived in Hebron, and his grandchildren are still there. If something's going on in Hebron, Abu Hamad is likely to know about it. His family is said to have ties to the Alzahanis. But Abu Hamad won't talk to anyone from the agency, not even Kayla. That's why your cover is perfect."
"It's not perfect. If Summers already has a deal in the works, then why would he send me over there to find out about the deal?" Foster shrugged.
"To find out about his daughter? To make sure the deal has no snafus?"
Liam shook his head. "And what about the language barrier?"
"That old fox speaks perfect English when he wants to. As to anyone else you need to talk to, Kayla will go with you. She knows a way around."
"She speaks Arabic?"
"Perfectly. Also Hebrew, Farsi, and Kurdish, and she can get by on Jordanian Levantine. But I think you'll find that most people will talk to you in English if they choose to talk at all."
"Getting back to my perfect cover, what reason would I have to talk to Abu Hamad?"
"You'll figure something out."
Liam checked his watch. "I better leave. Professor Cummings will give me a detention if I'm tardy." Foster blotted his mouth with his sixth napkin.
"Quite a sandwich."
"Around here, we call it a sandwich." They shook hands, and Liam left to make his way back to the federal building. As he walked down Clark Street, his phone rang. He looked at the screen. 502 area code.
"Hello, Deborah."
"Mr. Taggart, I want to talk to you again, but not on the phone."
"All right. Can you see me first thing tomorrow morning?"
"Make it 10. I want to be sure Sean's not at home."
Kayla was seated at her desk when Liam returned.
"How was your lunch? You'll have to take me to Portillo's one day."
"How do you know where we ate?"
"I'm a spy. We have satellite surveillance."
"What?"
Kayla laughed. "I just got off the phone with Harry. We were coordinating my travel to Israel next week."
Liam smiled.
"You might actually have a sense of humor."
"Oh, you'd be surprised."
Kayla turned her attention to the monitor and showed the afternoon's first slide.
"Do you remember Mufti Haj Muhammad Effendi Amin al-Husseini from this morning?"
Liam nodded and shoehorned himself into a seat beside Kayla.
"The Mufti of Jerusalem, fomenter of riots and strikes. Bad dude, snuck off to Lebanon in drag, joined there by his henchman, Grandfather Ibrahim."
Kayla raised her eyebrows.
"You did listen."
"Believe it or not."
"As I told you this morning, Amin and Ibrahim went into exile in Lebanon, but they used it as a base to incite further riots. It didn't take long for the French to issue an arrest warrant, and the two troublemakers were forced to escape from Lebanon into Iraq. They stayed there for 2 years.
In 1941, Amin sponsored a pro-Nazi coup and tried to overthrow the British-run government. When Britain restored order, Amin and Ibrahim fled to Tehran, where they were welcomed by the pro-Nazi Shah.
So they became Nazis?
Dyed in the wool. It suited their purpose. British agents nearly caught up with Amin and Ibrahim in Iran, and once again they had to flee, this time to Italy. Because they were constantly on the move, Ibrahim kept his family, Hamid, Maryam, Arif and Safiya, back at their home in Haifa. And that's where Arif al-Zahani grew up. While in Italy, Amin courted Mussolini. His purpose was to convince Il Duce to support the creation of an Arab state in Palestine, with Amin in charge, naturally. In return, he promised to supply Arab military support for the Axis. Mussolini was open to the idea, but wasn't in a position to make it happen. So, Amin and Ibrahim then travelled north and sought out the world's number one anti-Semite.
Hitler.
Correct. Amin and Ibrahim travelled to Berlin. There they met and ingratiated themselves with Hitler, trying to get his backing for a Palestinian state, again with Amin as supreme leader. Hitler admired Amin's blue eyes and told him he must have Aryan blood. She tapped the keyboard for a picture of Hitler and al-Husseini sitting together in animated conversation. The Arabs are Germany's natural friends, Amin said to Hitler, and he offered to train Muslim armies for the Reich. In exchange, Hitler told Amin exactly what he wanted to hear. Once Germany defeated Russia, the next step would be the destruction of the Jewish element residing in the Arab sphere under the protection of British power. In fact, Hitler told him, "The Jews are yours." Amin and Ibrahim found an apartment in Berlin. Between 1942 and 1944, they assisted Hitler by recruiting Arabs for the Waffen-SS and training Bosnian Muslims for the Nazi infantry. Amin's Bosnian Muslims were responsible for the death of 90% of Bosnia's Jewish community. Amin and Ibrahim met often with Himmler and Ribbentrop, and there's a strong basis for believing they toured the death camps with Eichmann, who treated Amin as a close friend. Al-Husseini's name was mentioned often at the Nuremberg trials, but by then he had escaped to Egypt, where he was welcomed by King Farouk. After the war, Amin and Ibrahim ended up in Gaza, once again heading up a group of militants. This time it was the Al-Jihad al-Muqaddas, the army of the Holy War. We know that group today as the Muslim Brotherhood, and it didn't take long for Amin and Ibrahim to latch onto another cause. By the end of 1945, there were 250,000 Jews living in displaced person camps throughout Germany, Austria, and Italy. They were the survivors of the Holocaust. They called themselves Sherit HaPleta, the surviving remnant. Overwhelmingly, the displaced persons, the DPs, wanted to emigrate to British Mandatory Palestine, but Britain had strict immigration quotas forged by Neville Chamberlain's 1939 White Paper. Quotas in the US, Britain, and Canada essentially closed all those doors as well. Everyone knew that the existence of the British and French mandates were temporary and unsustainable. But no matter what Britain envisioned for the post-war division of its territory, it was always rejected by Amin and the Arab leaders. They would have no part of sharing the land. They wanted it all. As a result, post-war Palestine was a cauldron of violence. From Amin and the Arabs, from Zionist paramilitary groups like the Ergin and the Haganah, who wanted open immigration, and from the British soldiers themselves. In the midst of the growing anarchy, Britain turned to the fledgling UN to work out the solution. An 11-nation committee was established, and known as UNSCOP, the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine. The members travelled to Palestine and concluded, not surprisingly, that the Arab objectives and the Jewish objectives could not be reconciled, but nonetheless, they proposed a division of the land. On November 29, 1947, the UN General Assembly voted and approved the plan for partition. The first portion dealt with the termination of the British mandate and withdrawal of the British troops. The second part was the establishment of borders for two separate states, an Arab state and a Jewish state. The exception was Jerusalem, which was to remain under international control. Here is a map of what they devised. A map of the partition territory appeared on Kayla's monitor. The UN's division, though it appeared to resemble a jigsaw puzzle, was based almost entirely upon ethnic demography. There were Jews living in the Arab portions and Arabs in the Jewish portions, but the lines were drawn to reflect the predominant culture. But Amin, the Arab League, and all of the surrounding Arab countries flatly rejected the UN partition plan and would not accept borders for either a Jewish state or an Arab state, no matter what the borders were. Ibrahim saw the future, and it was violent. He knew that a partition would never be peacefully implemented, and he quickly acted to position his family for an upcoming war. He sent Hamid to Jordan, and using his contacts, had him enlist in the Jordanian army as an officer. Given Ibrahim's influence, Hamid rose rapidly in the ranks and soon became a squad leader. By the time of the 1948 war, he was commanding a company. On May 13, 1948, the British pulled out of the Mandate, and the next day, May 14th, David Ben-Gurion took to the airwaves and proclaimed the declaration of the establishment of the State of Israel in the territories granted by the UN Partition Plan. The very next day, May 15th, the combined armies of the six Arab League states commenced a coordinated military invasion of Israel. Israel was attacked from all directions, Egypt from the south and Syria from the north. From the east, Jordan marched its army across the Jordan River and occupied the entire West Bank, including the eastern half of the city of Jerusalem. Hamid al-Zahani was in command of the Jordanian company that took Hebron. The territories captured by Jordan were referred to as the West Bank of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan and remained that way until 1967. By the way, it was never referred to as Palestine. Use of the term Palestine was forbidden by the King of Jordan. A ceasefire was negotiated, and an armistice was signed in April 1949. Not a peace treaty, mind you, just an armistice. They agreed to stop fighting, leaving the armies where they were. Jerusalem, which was originally intended to be international, was split down the middle for the first time in its history. Jordan on the east, Israel on the west. As it had in ancient times, Israel declared Jerusalem to be its capital. What became of the al-Zahanis after the 1948 war? Liam asked. Well, I told you Hamid was an officer in the battalion that captured Hebron. The Arab population there hailed Hamid as a hero, and he stayed there to make his home. Ibrahim had him appointed commander of the Jordanian army garrison in Hebron. Hamid built the house that Arif occupies today. Kayla looked at her watch. It's getting late and I want to finish. We'll jump ahead to the 60s because that was the era that launched the Palestinian movement. In 1964, the Arab League founded the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which once again sought eradication of the Jews in the State of Israel. Ibrahim was a member of the inner circle from the very beginning. For the PLO, its credo was armed violence. Since terrorism, shootings and bombings were Ibrahim's stock and trade, he was a valuable soldier in the cause. But his terrorist activities proved to be his undoing. When he attempted to bomb a Tel Aviv restaurant in 1965, a single shot from an IDF rifle hit the explosives in Ibrahim's arms, and he was blown to bits. There wasn't enough to bury. Hamid, enraged at his father's death, led a party of Arab regulars into West Jerusalem in a late-night attack, killing 14 civilians at a movie theatre. From then on, there was a price on Hamid's head. The 60s was also a period of military build-up, thanks to the Soviets who supplied arms to the Arab countries. As a result, Arab aggression against Israel increased, and it all came to a head in 1967. On May 15th, Egypt massed its troops and told the UN to remove its peacekeepers from Gaza and the Sinai, declaring, "Our basic objective will be the destruction of Israel. The Arab people want to fight." Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon lined up beside Egypt. Israel looked to the US, but deeply engaged in Vietnam and in a Cold War with the Soviets, Johnson told Israel to stand down. Do not fire the first shot. Israel realized it was going to go it alone, that it was only a matter of days before Nasser and the Arab League would attack. Greatly overmatched in troop size, weapons, tanks and air power, Israel also feared the use of poison gas, which Nasser had used before. So, on June 5, 1967, the entire Israeli Air Force took off in a surprise move at the breakfast hour and bombed the Egyptian airfields. Then, the IAF flew north and destroyed the Syrian airfields. Jordan, which had been warned not to enter the fray, honoured its pact with Egypt and announced, "The hour of revenge has come." Jordan began shelling Jerusalem. The battle for Jerusalem was fierce. Hamid brought his Hebron battalion north and attacked Jerusalem from the southern flank. but his aggression, like his father's, was to be his undoing. On June 7th, in a furious battle in the Kidron Valley just south of the Temple Mount, Hamid was shot and killed. Arif would have been 23 years old at the time. Now he had lost his grandfather and his father to Israeli gunfire. Later that same day, the Israeli army gained control of East Jerusalem and the Western Wall. Moshe Dayan declared, "We've reunited the city, the capital of Israel, never to part it again." The 1967 war was over in 6 days. Israeli ground troops forced the Jordanian army all the way back across the river into Jordan, capturing all of the West Bank territory Jordan had seized in 1948. Israel remained in control of the area. So, who does the land belong to? Who has the legitimate claim to the territories? Liam said. Kayla spread her hands. Britain? It captured it from the Ottomans in 1920. Jordan? It captured it in 1948. Israel? It captured it in 1967. The UN Security Council took up the issue after the war and adopted Resolution 242. But it's a complicated resolution with unclear meanings and intentionally vague provisions. 242 provided that Israel should withdraw from occupied territories to secure and recognized boundaries when there was a just and lasting peace. But it didn't specify which occupied territories, what recognized boundaries, or what would constitute a just and lasting peace. Furthermore, 242 didn't specify who would be entitled to occupy the territories after the withdrawal. The Palestinians are not mentioned at all in Resolution 242. And Israel has yet to withdraw from any occupied territories? Not true. Sinai was given back to the Egyptians after Camp David in 1978, and Gaza was given up to the Palestinian Authority in 2005. That amounts to over 90% of the land Israel captured in 1967. But what about the rest, the so-called disputed West Bank? Why do you say the resolution was intentionally vague? Resolution 242 didn't say that Israel should withdraw from all the occupied territories, or even the occupied territories. At the time it was being drafted, Arab states insisted that the resolution say all the territories, but the Security Council rejected the language. The withdrawal was purposely left vague for future negotiation. So, to this date, negotiations continue. Even now, almost 50 years later. There are 2.7 million Palestinians living in West Bank cities, under Israeli military authority, but Palestinian civil control. In 1995, at the end of the Oslo peace process, the West Bank was divided into three administrative divisions, or zones. Palestinian Authority was created to provide a government for certain West Bank towns in Gaza. Palestinian cities with no Israeli settlements were designated Zone A. The Palestinian Authority was given complete civil and police autonomy over Zone A cities. Israeli citizens and military are forbidden from entering without permission, although the IDF does enter when necessary on security or emergency missions. Jericho, Ramallah, and Nablus are examples of such cities. Zone B areas have joint Palestinian and Israeli control. There is an IDF presence, generally due to Israeli citizens living in the area. Zone C has full Israeli control, both civil and security, and consists of Israeli settlements in Samaria and Judea. What Oslo did not do was to recognize a Palestinian state or restrict settlement expansion. Liam nodded his understanding. The two lingering issues. Arif al-Zahani lives in Hebron. What zone is that? Kayla clicked on a slide of Hebron. It's a hybrid. Part Zone A and part Zone C. Zone A is designated H1, with 200,000 Arabs, and this little part here, she pointed to a shaded corner of the city, is H2, which is a Zone C settlement with 90 Jewish families. H1 and H2 are separated by conflicting ideologies and a flimsy cyclone fence. Hebron is one of the most dangerous cities in the world.
And that's where Sophie is?
We think so.
Chapter 35.
Lubana entered Sophie's room and found her, as she did most of the time, staring out the window and talking to Sweetness. She gently placed her hands on the child's shoulders.
You did not eat much dinner tonight, Sophie.
She shrugged.
How come?
I didn't like it.
It was Malupa. What didn't you like?
It was yucky.
It's just a casserole with rice, eggplant, and lamb. Some cauliflower, carrots. It's very good. What would you like instead?
A cheeseburger. I want to go to McDonald's.
Lubana laughed.
There are no McDonald's in Hebron.
Sophie turned back to the window.
Jada, I never see butterflies outside my window.
Where are all the butterflies in Hebron?
I don't know, sweetie. I'm sure there must be butterflies in Hebron.
In the summer, in my mother's garden, there are always lots of butterflies. Blue and brown ones, purple ones, little yellow ones. But monarchs are the prettiest of all.
Sophie looked up at her grandmother.
Mommy says you have to plant milkweed in your garden for the butterflies. That's where they lay their eggs.
Lubana smiled.
Your mother loved to garden. Even when she was a very little girl, we would garden together.
She shrugged.
Since she left, I don't garden anymore.
Sophie nodded and turned back to the window. The outbuilding was going through its shift change.
What are those people doing, Jada?
Sophie pointed at workers carrying satchels and backpacks from the outbuilding and putting them into the trunks of their cars.
I'm not sure, dear. I've never been in that building. Your daddy insists that we stay out. He tells me that they are preparing food and supplies for the poor people of Hebron. Because they are wrapping food and medical supplies, the building must be kept sterile.
Where does the food go?
I am told that it goes to a food bank in the poorest sections of our city. Why do you spend so much time looking out the window?
Sophie turned in her chair and reached for Lubana's wrists.
I'm looking for my home, Jada. I want to go home. Can't you talk to Jadi and tell him that I don't want to live here?
Tears formed in Lubana's eyes.
Why, child? Am I not good to you? I love you so much.
I love you too, Jada, but this is not my home. These are not my clothes. I miss my daddy. I miss my friends.
Sophie's requests gave way to sobs.
I just want to go home. Please tell Jadi.
Lubana stood.
I cannot. Even if I wanted to, Jadi will not change his mind. You must accept that this is now your home.
She turned to leave.
Jamila will be here soon, and we will all bake cookies. Do you want to do that?
Sophie nodded and sniffled.
Try to be happy. There are lots of people here that love you.
Chapter 36. So, you're going to Louisville again tomorrow? Catherine said, bringing dinner to the table. Liam nodded and took a sip of wine.
6 o'clock out of O'Hare. I'll be back in the afternoon.
Oh, great. That means you'll be getting up at 4 a.m. and rustling through the closet.
I can sleep in my apartment. Or in the guest room.
The hell you will. Pass the pasta, please. I'll get up, make you coffee, and go back to bed when you leave. How did your session with the demure Miss Cummings go?
Fact-intensive, but I have a better appreciation of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Kayla's very knowledgeable.
Oh, it's Kayla, is it?
Liam smiled.
NORAD has detected a blip of hostile jealousy on the horizon. She's gorgeous.
Then I guess you're not going to be thrilled to hear that she's going with me when I travel to Israel next week.
Liam.
Liam shrugged. She's a woman of many talents.
Is that right? Many talents? Well, maybe you should sleep at your apartment.
Cat, I'm only teasing you.
Well, I don't like it.
She's very pretty, and she's probably got her eyes on you.
Liam leaned over and gave Catherine a kiss.
Stop being jealous.
Well, she seems very flirtatious. You told me she had you sit right next to her at her computer. For 3 hours? I mean,
Come on. Now with the two of you traveling around the world...
Cat, stop.
It was a tiny little office. She's been nothing but all business.
You're being unreasonable.
I shouldn't have made the comment about many talents. I was trying to be funny. That was a mistake. Well, I don't have to like it. You've got nothing to worry about. I've got talents too, Liam.
Catherine smiled seductively.
Aye, that you do. And don't you forget it.
Liam arrived precisely at 10 a.m. Deborah stood in the doorway for a moment, scanning the street.
No one followed me, Deborah.
She nodded and stepped back.
Would you like a cup of coffee?
I don't mean to rattle you, but it's better for us not to talk in your home. Let's just take a walk.
Are you serious?
She looked around her entry hall.
They bugged my house?
I don't know that, but there are definitely people looking for your brother, on both sides of the law.
Why take the chance?
She stepped back into the foyer.
Let me get my coat.
As they strolled around the corner, Deborah said,
I can't tell you much about what's happening lately. He doesn't want to involve me, but whatever plans he's made, they're not working out. They've stalled. He's not sure he can count on the help he was expecting. He says he'd like to talk to you. He wants to know what kind of help you can give him.
Is he planning on paying Al-Zahani money for Sophie's release?
I don't know anything more than I just told you.
Where is he?
Deborah shook her head.
How am I supposed to talk to him? Did he give you a phone number?
He doesn't want to talk to you on the phone. He's worried that the call can be traced and his location will be discovered. He said he wants an in-person meeting in a busy restaurant.
Okay, I'll do that. Where and when?
In Santa Monica. Friday at 1 o'clock. He said if you double-cross him, you'll never learn where the money is. I told him that you would not betray him.
Oh, you did?
It's in your eyes, Mr. Taggart. You have honest eyes. I'm a very good judge of people. I told Jack I trust you. That sooner or later we have to trust someone.
Thank you. You're right about having to trust someone. He can't manage this plan by himself. And frankly, you're right about me. I don't know about the eyes, but I'm an honest person.
Santa Monica's a big place. Where am I supposed to meet him? Belmonte's on Wilshire near 5th, Friday at 1. He said to please come alone. The reservation will be in your name.
Agreed.
Deborah reached over and squeezed Liam's arm. Please help him.
I'll try, I promise. How are you communicating with him?
We each have safe prepaid cell phones purchased by other people. Untraceable.
Nothing is untraceable. Make your calls quick. No more than 30 seconds.
The Deacons led Western Alabama by 21 points. Thomas was on fire. With 8 minutes remaining in the game, he already had a double-double, 26 points and 12 rebounds.
Marcus whispered to Darius during a timeout. We got 7 points too much. Mr. Kelson said 14. Make it less than 14.
Can't help it, Darius said.
Thomas is a stud in the post. He's dominating their bigs. We gotta do something. Let him steal a couple passes at midcourt. 2, 3 fast breaks, they'll catch up.
Darius looked at the packed stands.
Madison Square Garden.
Second round of the East Regional. TV cameras everywhere, NBA scouts, notepads. Every errant pass would be slow-mode.
I ain't fucking up my future.
The whistle blew and Marcus brought the ball up for the Deacons. He stood between the circles, passed up a clean look at Thomas, and telegraphed a pass to the corner.
Western's point guard snatched it in midair and took it down for an easy layup. On the next play, Darius got a ball screen from Marcus and drained a jumper. But Marcus was whistled for an illegal screen, and the basket was waved off. That was his 4th foul, and he was called to the bench. As he walked by Darius, he said,
Spreads at 19. It's up to you now.
Western made both free throws and trailed by 17. Darius took the inbounds pass and fed Oliver, who missed a 3. Western quickly responded on transition and scored on a 3-point play. The spread sat at 14. But on the next play, Darius saw an opening, spun to his left, and scored on a reverse layup.
highlight stuff.
What the fuck?
Mouthed Marcus as Darius ran by the bench. Timeout was called with 2 minutes left and the score at 81-65.
16, man. We still need to drop two more,
Marcus whispered in Darius's ear. The horn blew and Marcus re-entered the game. At half court, he lost his dribble. Western's guard scooped it up and scored on the breakaway. Marcus breathed a sigh of relief. 14 points. 1:45 to go. Just have to keep it there. The spread remained at 14 as each side missed a shot. But with 12 seconds left, Thomas grabbed a rebound and flipped the outlet pass to Darius, who took it coast to coast, finishing with a windmill that brought the guard into its feet. Final score, 83-67. In the locker room, Marcus pulled Darius aside.
What are you going to tell Mr. Kelson now, Darius? What are we going to do? He told us 14. He told us not to give the ball to Thomas.
Ain't my fault. Thomas had 31.
And the move at the end? With only 12 seconds? Was that Thomas or was that you hot-dogging it for the highlight reels? You should have just held the ball 12 fucking seconds. Even Coach was pissed at you for piling on. Mr. Kelson paid us and you fucked us.
Darius shoved Marcus back into the lockers.
Look, asshole. Did you see all those NBA scouts? The whole country's watching the tourney. Tonight, they seen Darius. They seen the best. I ain't gonna dribble it off my knee like you did. I'm going in the first round, maybe lottery. You think I'm gonna tank my career for some rich fucking a Bentley? I'll be having 10 Bentleys. He ain't gonna like it. He paid us.
Chapter 37. Liam walked into Belmonte's promptly at 1 p.m. and approached the hostess stand. The restaurant, a seafood concept with white tablecloths and upbeat music, was busy serving its lunch crowd. The waitstaff, men and women alike, were young and wore white shirts with large Pacific blue neckties, patterned with splashes of colorful sea creatures. Do you have a reservation for Taggart? The young lady smiled.
Yes, we do, and your party's already here. Let me show you to your table.
She led him toward a crescent booth where a pretty young woman in a coral sundress was seated with a glass of wine, examining the menu. Liam stopped. I don't think this is the right table. The woman looked up.
Please sit down, Mr. Taggart.
She held out her hand.
My name's Marcy.
Okay. Liam nodded and turned to the hostess. I'll have a Macallan 18 and a single piece of ice. He settled into the booth.
Where's Jack? Safe and sound.
I need to speak directly to him, not through a go-between. She shook her head.
I'm afraid you're stuck with the go-between.
I've come a long way, on a short turnaround, and I'm not in the mood for a game.
No games, Mr. Taggart. I'm here as a proxy of sorts. I know his situation, and I have my instructions.
Liam sighed and took a sip of his scotch.
It's Liam.
Where does Summers' deal stand with Al-Zahani?
He doesn't know. He's beginning to doubt there's a deal in place.
Why?
Marcy tilted her head in a shrug. He has a private email account that was set up for communication with the people who are in charge of handling the transaction. He's not getting any meaningful responses, just an occasional, be patient. He's come to believe they've abandoned him.
Where's the money?
It's in a safe place.
Then they haven't abandoned him. You can be sure they're looking for him.
He's considered that possibility, but they don't know where he is.
The waitress returned to the table. They picked up their menus, studied them briefly, and ordered. Whoever they are, they know that sooner or later Jack has to show himself, Liam said.
There's a focal point. Sophie.
Correct. What can you tell me about the deal, Marcy? How was it made and why does he think it's stalled? Marcy swiveled to face Liam and spoke softly.
After Sophie was kidnapped, Jack was approached with a proposition. He was working on a large business deal that was set to close through an escrow. Jack was to arrange for the escrow money to be sent to a sham account. He was assured that part of the money would be used for Sophie's return.
Who gave this assurance?
Jack doesn't want me to disclose any names to you at this point.
The person who approached Jack. What do we know about him and his connection to Al-Zahani?
I'm sorry, I was instructed not to talk about the person. Jack was told that this person had made the arrangements to buy Sophie's return out of Hebron. What ultimately happens to the rest of the money is not Jack's concern. He doesn't want any of it.
Did Jack ever have confirmation of this arrangement from Al-Zahani?
No. He hasn't had any contact with the Al-Zahani since they picked up Sophie at his house.
Liam grimaced. The person. The entire scenario rests on the credibility of the person. Did Jack ever consider the possibility that this person may be running a number on Jack and may have never contacted Al-Zahani at all?
Of course. Jack may be desperate, but he's not stupid. To Jack, the person was a godsend. Jack had tried all the legal avenues, the U.S. government, the Israeli government. He just kept running into stone walls. Then along comes this businessman who has powerful contacts in the Middle East and can make it all happen. As far as Jack knew, millions of dollars, maybe tens of millions, would be more than enough to finance Sophie's return. Whether it's a payoff to Al-Zahani or otherwise doesn't really matter to Jack. The escrow money went to a Panamanian account that Jack set up.
Liam shook his head. It's so foolish. You know two of the other accomplices are dead.
We heard that. Jack doesn't know if it's true.
It's true. They're dead.
Well, it took all three to complete the theft. Jack couldn't have misdirected the wire without them. They were recruited by...
She shrugged. I know. The person.
Why doesn't Jack want me to know who this person is? I guess he still holds out the possibility that the man will do what he said. Rescue Sophie. There's a lot of money in that account. If the person actually made contact with Al-Zahani, and if there's any truth to what he said, then there are millions of reasons that Sophie can be brought back to the U.S.
The waitress returned and set the lunch plates on the table.
You're very brave to come here, Liam said. Do you understand you're putting yourself in the line of fire?
Why are you doing this?
I like spy novels.
Liam took a bite of his sautéed mahi-mahi sandwich with zesty basil butter and garden sprouts.
He made a face.
And I'm very fond of Jack. You told Deborah you could help us. What can you do?
To be honest with you, Marcy, I'm not sure. I can tell you that I'll go to the Palestinian territories and try to open the channels. I'll try to find out if there is or ever was a deal. If I can facilitate Sophie's return, I will. But I'm not going to lie to you. I can't hand over the escrow money in exchange for Sophie. There's no way the government will let Al-Zahani get his hands on that money. He's a suspected terrorist.
I don't think Jack believes that Al-Zahani is a terrorist. But if you're not sure what you can do and you won't let Al-Zahani have any money, why did you tell Deborah you can help? You don't have an alternative plan. You don't have anything. Why did you lie to her? Did you think we'd be so stupid as to let Jack come here and be grabbed by you at this restaurant?
She stood to leave.
Wait, Marcy, sit down. I didn't lie to anyone. I told her I would try to help, and I will do everything I can.
I'll be on the ground over there. I'm going next week, and I should be able to find out something, at least more than Jack presently knows.
And I've got the support of the State Department.
What do you mean, the State Department?
They know about the money?
They know about the money. Hell, everyone knows about the money. But they also suspect that Al-Zahani may want to use this money for some kind of terrorist activity. And that may, in fact, be why Al-Zahani took Sophie in the first place. They want me to get as much information as I can. And they think that by using me, a private investigator hired by Jack's family to find Sophie, people will open up to me. Maybe I can get close enough to Al-Zahani to find out what's really going on. If there's a deal, they want to put me in the middle of it. If there's no deal, they want me to make the offer. It's our best shot.
You'd get in the middle of this with a terrorist?
Liam shrugged.
That's very brave. What about the money?
Liam shook his head. It's got to go back to the escrow. To the guy who owns the company, not to a terrorist.
I just don't think Jack believes that Al-Zahani is a terrorist. A deceitful, manipulative bastard, yes, but a terrorist? Jack wouldn't give money to a terrorist. Jack tells me Al-Zahani's a man who maintains a very high standard of living and probably requires a lot of cash. Jack figures he might be overextended. After all, it's hard for a doctor to pull down that kind of money practicing in a Palestinian town. He may need the money badly.
Liam nodded. I understand. But I've heard the doctor is quite wealthy.
Have you counted his cash?
Liam smiled.
Fair enough. No, I haven't. Jack also believes that the person might need to use the money to finance a rescue. It might mean hiring people. It might mean paying off local governmental people. Jack doesn't care who gets paid off. All he cares about is bringing Sophie home. So why shouldn't he stick with the person?
You and Jack already know the answer, or you wouldn't be here. So, what are Jack's options? Is he going to go to Palestine himself with a bag of money? Is he going to hire another person? Is he going to recruit an army of mercenaries, soldiers of fortune, to sneak arms into Israel and firestorm their way in and out of the country? Don't you think that's a little out of Jack's element? And bear in mind, Marcy, someone has already killed two people. Jack would be in the crosshairs if they knew where he was. As you've described the embezzlement scheme to me, there were three active participants, and two of them are now dead. Liam took another bite of his sandwich and wrinkled his nose.
Ugh!
Give me a good Chicago sandwich anytime.
What do you want me to tell Jack?
Why don't you get him on the phone and let me talk to him myself? She shook her head.
I can't. I have to follow his wishes. I can talk to him privately. What do you want me to tell him?
Tell him to keep his head down. Tell him to stay out of sight, and tell him to set up a communication channel with me. She pulled a cell phone out of her pocket.
I'll be right back.
She walked outside to make the call. Liam signaled for the waitress. I'll have another McAllen, and you can take the sandwich. What's the possibility I can get a jumbo char dog with relish, hot peppers, tomatoes, and a pickle? The waitress put a plastic smile on her face.
I'm sorry, that's not on the menu, sir. May I interest you in something else? Our avocado whitefish burger is very popular.
Liam sadly shook his head. She smiled and left to fill the order. Marcy returned and slid into the booth.
He says he's grateful for your help. He urges you to do what you can. If you can set up an exchange or get the Israelis or the Palestinian Authority involved, he'll do everything he can to help you, including supplying details about the money and the other participants. He'll do whatever he has to do to get Sophie back. If you want him to trust you, you have to trust him and respect his need to stay out of sight.
A moment later, the waitress returned with Liam's drink and the check. Liam reached into his pocket for cash. Marcy stopped him.
I'm on an expense account. Jack told me that I was to treat.
She dug into her purse and pulled out her wallet. Marcy, how does Jack propose to raise Sophie when she returns? He's facing 20 years or more. She nodded slightly.
I know, but that's Jack's business.
Are you prepared to harbor a fugitive?
Look, I'm only trying to help Jack get his daughter back. She's being held captive in a violent city. What I do is my business.
Liam smiled. All right. How do I stay in contact? I don't want to come back to Santa Monica. I don't care for fish sandwiches. She wrote down a cell phone number.
Here. This is how you reach us. You leave a text message.
Liam looked at the paper. It was Deborah's number. Chapter 38. Darius left the practice facility at 9 p.m. and started walking across the quad toward his dorm. The frozen grass crunched beneath his shoes. Coach's game plan for the third round kept playing out in his mind. So did his stellar performance against Western Alabama in the second round, clips of which were being shown hourly on SportsCenter. So far, it had been a great tournament for him, and he was the topic of every sports talk panel. Anti-gravity, they said. He walked through the brisk night with a spring in his step. The familiar black Bentley pulled up alongside the curb. Darius pretended not to see the car and kept walking with his head down. Kelson's chauffeur dashed around the car and blocked his path.
Mr. Kelson wants a word with you.
He put a strong grip on Darius's arm, led him back to the car, opened the back door, and rudely pushed him in. Darius was placed in the middle of the back seat with Kelson on one side and a large man in a gray wool coat on the other.
Haven't I been good to you, Darius? Am I not like a father to you?
Look, Mr. Kelson, I'm sorry about the other night, but I had to make a good showing if I want to be a high pick.
High pick?
You're only a sophomore, Darius. You've got another 2 years of eligibility.
No, sir, I'm going to declare this year. Coach says I got a good shot at being a lottery pick. That's why I had to play real good.
I said 14, Darius.
Then Kelson's voice rose.
14! Not 16, you little punk!
Hey, look, man, I said I was sorry. And I don't want to do this no more. I'm out. I gotta worry about my future. I don't want your money no more.
Money?
Do you know how much money you cost me Tuesday?
You and your future?
No, sir. Show him, Yevgeny.
Yevgeny's fist slammed hard into Darius's stomach. It knocked the wind out of him. He couldn't catch his breath.
Show Mr. Anti-Gravity how much money his high-flying showboat cost me against Western Alabama,
Kelson said calmly. Yevgeny, a smile on his face, took a police baton from the seat beside him and swung it hard, striking Darius on the shin. He screamed in agony.
Ah! My leg! You broke my leg!
Let's see how high you can fly now.
Darius doubled up on the seat, his arms around his knee. The chauffeur walked around and opened the back door.
Too bad about your leg, Kelson said. Accidents will happen. Tough break for the Deacons, though. Thought they might go all the way. But, you know, the good news is, broken legs can heal. Come next year, after your rehab, you'll be back. Maybe not quite as quick, but you'll play. And you and I will talk.
Darius was thrown from the car onto the parkway.
Don't ever cross me again, Kelson said. You give me 2 more years. You owe me. You belong to me.
The Bentley pulled away, leaving Darius in the parkway. He lay on the grass, crying, shaking from the incident and unable to walk. Several minutes later, a young woman spotted him and cautiously approached. She set her backpack down beside him.
Hey, are you okay? Do you need help?
I've been mugged. I think my leg is busted.
I'll get someone here.
She dialed 911 on her cell. She smiled encouragingly.
They're coming right now.
Then she looked closer.
Are you Darius McCord?
Shortly thereafter, an ambulance arrived and transported him to Memorial Hospital. While he was waiting to be x-rayed, Darius's mother rushed into the emergency room.
Oh, my baby. What did they do to you? Mama, they busted up my leg. Took my money. Who did this to you? I don't know. I didn't see him coming. They got me from behind, knocked me down, and hit me with a ball bat. Then they ran off. There was 2 or 3 of them, Mama. I didn't have a chance.
Chapter 39. Catherine slid her pillow over and snuggled up to Liam.
Are you awake?
I've been up for a while. I didn't want to move. You were sleeping so soundly.
It's 3 a.m. Are you thinking about Summers and where he might be?
I got a pretty good idea where he is. He's in Hawaii.
Catherine propped herself up on her elbow.
Did Marcy tell you that?
No. When she pulled out her wallet to pay the check, I saw a debit card from the Bank of Hawaii, so that's my best guess.
Did you get her last name?
He nodded.
Catherine laid her head on Liam's arm. With her fingernails, she drew little circles on his chest.
Sounds like you and I need to go to Hawaii.
Liam smiled.
We'll just go sit on the beach and wait for Summers to walk by.
I had something a little more romantic in mind.
Liam rolled over and kissed her on the neck.
I bet you do. You always do.
The morning sun began to peek through the draperies, and Catherine was still lying on Liam's arm.
Many, many talents, he said with a purr.
You better remember that when you go to Israel next week with Miss Gorgeous.
You want me all to yourself?
Damn right I do.
Liam got out of bed, took a few steps toward the bathroom, and stopped.
You know, Kat, I don't think he has the money.
Seriously?
Why?
Just a feeling.
It might be in an account that he controls, but maybe not.
Then who has it?
Good question. Maybe the person who may have never talked to Al-Zahani or ever made a deal. Who may just be working Jack. And if so, when he gets Jack to show his face, there'll be a third fatality.
Catherine looked at the clock.
Shit, I gotta get going. I've got court at 9:30. Kelson versus Jenkins and Fairchild is up on the status call.
Courtroom 1506 was busy, especially on status days, which were known as Sherwin's Cattle Call. Judge Sherwin, trying to move his lengthy docket, allowed only a few minutes to each group of lawyers, just enough time for them to inform him of their progress. When her case was called, Catherine and two other attorneys quickly approached the bench. Kelson's attorney informed the judge that discovery was moving along well, and that several depositions had been scheduled. The judge then ordered all non-expert fact discovery to be completed within 120 days.
I'm going to set a preliminary trial date for next January, Judge Sherwin said. Final pretrial orders to be completed by January 5th. Pretrial conference on January 8th. Trial to begin January 17th.
What? January 17th? Kelson shouted from the back of the courtroom. What the hell? The judge looked over and beckoned Kelson forward with his index finger.
Come up here, sir.
Kelson approached the bench with a determined walk. What do I have to wait until January? They stole my money. I want a trial right now. Isn't there a speedy trial act or something? Judge Sherwin looked down at the attorneys.
Who is this man?
That's Mr. Kelson, said the plaintiff's attorney. He owns the company.
Mr. Kelson,
Judge Sherwin said,
you have a lawyer. Your lawyer will address this court. Don't ever shout in my courtroom again. He'll talk for you.
Well, he's not talking. I want a speedy trial.
He's doing just fine. January, if we can hold to it, would be an early setting on my calendar. I don't want any more outbursts in my courtroom. Do you understand?
Your Honor, they stole $88 million from me, those lawyers. I trusted them and they screwed me over. I want my money. I don't want to wait until January.
I'm not getting through to you, am I?
No. Not if you want to stall this case until January. I want my money. Maybe I'm not getting through to you.
Mr. Kelson, do you understand the phrase, contempt of court?
Of course.
Well, you're in it. Do you need my deputies to take you into custody so you can better appreciate courtroom decorum?
No.
One more word and you're going to spend the next week in the Cook County Jail. Now am I getting through to you?
Kelson nodded.
The court will take a short recess.
Judge Sherwin pointed to Kelson's attorney.
Talk to your client.
We're very sorry, Your Honor, Kelson's lawyer said. Mr. Kelson is obviously quite upset about the theft of $88 million.
That's understandable.
Chapter 40.
Because there were no direct flights from Chicago O'Hare to Ben-Gurion International, the trip to Tel Aviv would take 15 hours. Liam tried to sleep, but the cramped coach seats were increasingly uncomfortable. In contrast, Kayla sat tall and composed, reading, shuffling department papers, making notes.
How do you do that? It seems like we've been in these seats for days.
She shrugged and smiled.
Kayla Cummings. That's a pretty name. Are you married?
I was. My husband died.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you have any children?
She shook her head and went back to her reading.
Where did you grow up?
Liam said after a minute. She smiled and put down her papers.
You're just full of personal questions, aren't you?
Occupational hazard, I suppose. I'm a PI, and I'd like to know more about the person I'm working with. Kayla shifted in her seat.
What about you? Are you married? Engaged?
Liam smiled.
No, but I'm working on it.
The attorney, Miss Lockhart?
Good guess.
Not really a guess, it's pretty obvious. So what does working on it mean? That's an odd way of phrasing it. What's standing in your way?
Oh, now look who's asking the personal questions.
Kayla smiled.
Ah, you're avoiding my question. How come the two of you haven't taken the next step?
Liam shrugged.
I can't give you a reason. Maybe it just hasn't been the right time.
Do you have a boyfriend?
Kayla laughed. You're right, this is getting too personal. We should keep it on a professional basis. We're headed to Israel to find out what we can about Al-Zahani and his group. Is there a deal in play? If not, can we put one in play? Hopefully you'll be able to sniff out some information, maybe even make contact with Arif. I know the land, the people, the culture. And I know about the evil doctor. I'll help you in any way I can. It's probably best for us to leave the personal doors closed.
Kayla went back to her reading, and Liam wrestled with the stiff little El Al pillow, trying to give sleep another chance. He folded it, he stuffed it between his shoulder and his neck, he placed it against the window, and he even laid it on the tray table. Kayla watched in amusement.
Why aren't you tired? How can you just sit there looking comfortable?
Kayla smiled.
It helps to be half your size.
Tell me something, why are you so certain that Al-Zahani is a terrorist?
Kayla paused for a moment.
Earlier this year, there was a wedding in Hebron, at Marat HaMachpelah, the tomb of the patriarchs. A car full of terrorists opened fire on the wedding party and then drove away. 4 innocent people were killed, and others were injured. A week later, they caught one of the shooters. I interviewed him briefly at the hospital. He was dying, almost too weak to talk. But he told me that Faiz Talib and Nizar Muhammad had sent them on the attack. I've since discovered that Al-Zahani is associated with those men.
That's it? He's associated?
There's more. We'll save it for a later time.
And now he's got Sophie.
Right. And he seeks to trade her for millions of dollars. It makes perfect sense. Millions of dollars to fund another terrorist plot. We can't let it happen.
The plane started its descent, and Liam stared out the window at Tel Aviv, its beaches, green parks, and span of high-rise hotels.
Beautiful.
Kayla nodded.
When Mark Twain visited here in 1867, he called the land desolate and unlovely. There's a famous quote from him. Even the olive and cactus, those fast friends of a worthless soil, had almost deserted the country.
He was right, you know.
And it stayed that way for close to 100 years, until it became the state of Israel. What you're seeing is Israeli development.
Ben-Gurion International was humming when they arrived.
Follow me, Kayla said, bypassing security, opening a side door, and shepherding Liam through immigration control and into a waiting car.
As they settled into the back seat, Kayla said to the driver,
23 David HaMelech.
Yes, ma'am, the driver replied.
The YMCA.
What? The YMCA? Liam said.
Are you serious?
They're putting me up at a YMCA? All the time I spent in Northern Ireland, the CIA never put me at a YMCA. Is this how the agency operates now?
The driver threw his arms into the air and started singing the familiar song.
Really? Liam said. The YMCA?
The driver snorted through his bursts of laughter. The YMCA is across the street from the King David Hotel, where we'll be staying in Jerusalem,
Kayla said between giggles.
Oh, Jesus, Liam shook his head.
Are you guys having a real good time picking on the poor Irish chump?
Well, now that you mention it, she said, smiling.
She pointed at the horizon.
The airport is southeast of Tel Aviv. Our route to Jerusalem parallels the 1949 Armistice Agreement line, the Green Line, east, then south, and finally around to the east again, from one side of Israel to the other on a winding highway. If one travelled straight across the country, the distance from Tel Aviv to the West Bank, from the Mediterranean to Samaria, is as short as 11 miles.
Not very far for a rocket to travel, Liam observed.
You're not the first to come to that conclusion.
Once into the countryside, Caleb pointed at the hills, lush with foliage, pine trees, vegetable farms, flowers and greenhouses.
Israel in the spring, verdant and plentiful.
The land of milk and honey?
That's an interesting biblical phrase. The referenced honey doesn't come from bees. It comes from crushed dates. They grow on date palms in the valleys of the desert.
The car dropped them at the King David just before noon. Liam's room was on a top floor with a balcony overlooking the walls of Jerusalem's old city. It was a 10-minute walk to the Jaffa Gate and from there to the Via Dolorosa, the crowded market passageway where Liam planned to make the acquaintance of Jamal Abu Hamad. After a 90-minute nap, Liam met Kayla for a snack in the King's Garden restaurant.
What can you tell me about Abu Hamad? Liam said.
Well, he's an Arab and he currently lives in East Jerusalem. Before that, he lived in Hebron. His family and the Al-Zahonis go back a long time, to Haifa. He knows Arif and he has his ear to the ground in Hebron. He owns a shop in the Muslim quarter of the old city. He used to be a resource for us. But there was an incident several years ago, and he will no longer knowingly be an asset. That's why you're so valuable in this matter.
Why would he cooperate with me? I'm an American, and we're underwriting the occupation of his homeland. Aren't we the great Satan?
Although we're mincing words here, Liam, Palestine was never considered the Arab homeland. Arabia is their homeland, over 1 million square miles of the Arabian Peninsula. The holy cities of Mecca and Medina, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Oman, Qatar, Kuwait, Jordan, those are Arab homelands. The West Bank was never considered the Arab homeland.
Does Abu Hamad live in a Zone A city?
No. Abu Hamad lives in East Jerusalem. 66 years ago he lived in Haifa. When the 1948 war began, Abu Hamad's family followed the Arab commands, left Haifa and fled to Jordan. After the 1948 war, they moved to Hebron. Later, Jamal moved to East Jerusalem when it was still under Jordanian occupation. The old city, where you'll be going today, was captured by Jordan in 1948 and was off-limits to Israelis until 1967. All the holy sites, the Temple Mount, the Western Wall, Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Dome of the Rock and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, shrines for all three Abrahamic religions, were blocked off by barbed wire. The square that now sits in front of the Western Wall was a slum. Today, under Israeli law, everyone is allowed access. The old city has four quarters, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, and Armenian. Abu Hamad's shop is in the Muslim quarter, accessible easily through the Jaffa Gate.
Liam stood, put his folded napkin on the table.
Then I'm off to the old city to pay Mr. Abu Hamad a visit.